Welcome to The Debrief here at ABC News Live. I'm Aaron Katursky. Coming up, it's being called one of the darkest days in New Zealand after a gunman opens fire on two mosques. 49 people are dead. Well, going to tell you why some people who actually need extra time on the SAT are worried about what went down this week in the college admissions cheating scandal. And we'll take you to a rally in New York, one of many going on around the globe to call attention to climate change, right after these headlines.
The SEC has now hit Volkswagen and the company's former CEO with charges over the carmaker's emissions scandal. Federal regulators say senior executives, including former head Martin Winterkorn, knew that hundreds of thousands of cars in the U.S. were rigged to cheat emissions tests.
Israel is striking back after a rocket attack into Tel Aviv.
The Israeli army says it carried out airstrikes on 100 Hamas targets in the Gaza Strip, including military headquarters, rocket manufacturing plants, and naval sites. No injuries have been reported.
Animal activists are calling for a criminal investigation after another horse death at a racetrack in California. The horse was put down after breaking both front ankles at the Santa Anita track. It's the 22nd horse death since Christmas, and it comes just 2 days after racing resumed. Track officials are now banning the use of whips and drugs on horses during race days.
Facebook is losing Chris Cox, who was the chief product officer, and Chris Daniels, head of WhatsApp. Both are leaving. Cox joined Facebook over a decade ago and helped create Facebook's news feed feature.
It's the first morning in orbit for a Russian-American crew that docked with the International Space Station overnight. NASA astronaut Christina Cook, making her first trip to the station, was the first to come through the hatch. The mission follows October's aborted launch that failed 2 minutes into the flight.
Forty-nine people are dead in New Zealand after a gunman opened fire at two mosques in Christchurch. We want to get straight to our senior foreign correspondent here at ABC News, Ian Pannell, to catch us up on the latest. Ian, this happened during Friday prayers.
Yeah, that's right. Friday midday prayers is the main prayer time throughout the week. It's the one where lots of people, more people tend to attend. Christchurch in New Zealand only has three mosques, and two of them were hit by this attack today. Bear in mind, this is a country that has never experienced a terrorist attack before. What we understand happened was that the gunman, who was an extreme right-wing white supremacist, entered the gun carrying multiple weapons, we understand, or certainly had multiple weapons, and opened fire on the congregation there, on worshippers. Then there was another shooting at another mosque. It's not clear at the moment whether it was the same shooter. So he moved from the Al Noor Mosque to the Linwood Mosque. More people shot there, more people killed, more people injured. As I say, the worst incident of its kind clearly ever in New Zealand. But some people will be saying part of a much broader pattern worldwide.
Oh, and to that end, we're going to speak with our contributor, John Cohen, formerly of the Department of Homeland Security, coming up. But I wanted to ask you about this particular suspect, Ian, because he did seem steeped in a lot of ideology that has been cropping up of late, particularly online.
Yes, and certainly at the far extreme end of that. But yes, there is a network of people out there. This has been a growing trend. There have been increasing numbers of attacks that have been attributed to far-right extremist terrorists. You know, there tends to be a specific categorization of what we think a terrorist is and what motivations they have. This is further proof that actually things have changed. The number of terrorist attacks last year actually went down, but the number of attacks that have been carried out under the pretext of being part of a far-right, white supremacist extreme mantra has actually gone up. And the deliberate targeting of Muslims at prayer on Friday is proof of that. Now, he was recording, he was live streaming as he went on his murder spree. But he also very clearly said that this was targeted against what he called immigrants. Now, not all those people anyway who would have been at those mosques would necessarily have been immigrants. They would have been people who've lived in New Zealand, born in New Zealand. But nevertheless, that is the backdrop. And if you only have to look at the other people that he said that he admired, that he revered, that he followed, that he copied. They were also people who felt that they were striking out against immigration, striking out against different religions like Islam and Judaism, people who also feel that they're part of a backlash against some liberal elite trend in society. So there's a whole bunch of different things that are thrown together. But also, I think it's important to say that we quite often, refer to people who carry out attacks, whether it's mass shootings or terrorist attacks like this, we use this phrase that they are mentally unwell. Now, clearly, anybody who carries out an attack of this type would fit into that category. And you only have to look at this manifesto that he released online, more than 70 pages long. It's kind of all over the place in terms of what it is that he railed against, what it is he was opposed to. So it's not entirely coherent in some senses, but it does fit that broad spectrum of anti-establishment, far-right, white supremacist creed that is breeding an increasing number of terrorist attacks targeted often at immigrant communities, certainly at religious minorities.
And that problem that you raise, Ian, has been particularly acute here in the United States. So I want to turn to ABC News contributor John Cohen, formerly of the Department of Homeland Security, who studies this stuff. Because, John, the number of attacks prescribed to right-wing extremists in the United States is only on the increase. In fact, last year, 2018, there were more of them than at any time in the U.S. since 1995 and the Oklahoma City Federal Building bombing.
Yeah, and that's correct, and I totally agree with what Ian has been discussing over the last few minutes. We have seen an increase in this country in targeted attacks by individuals who are motivated by far-right wing extremist ideology. We've also experienced an increase in hate crimes by these people motivated by these same ideologies, targeting immigrants, African Americans, Muslims and Jews. So there's real concern amongst the law enforcement community that we are in the midst of a trend in which the primary threat facing the United States today comes from individuals who are motivated to violence by far right-wing extremist ideologies.
And that seems to thrive online. It feels like Charlottesville really brought that to the fore, where previously fringe elements scattered across the country in small pockets were able to gather up critical mass.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I'm often asked when I'm speaking publicly or meeting with people, are there more white supremacists? Are there more right-wing violent extremists? And the answer to that question is, from everything we can see, no. But there are two important factors that have enhance the threat. The first is the widespread use of social media and the internet. People who were once isolated by geography can now interconnect on a global basis. They can share ideas. They can spread their hateful rhetoric. They can share videos and other information about attacks. And that serves to inspire those within the community who are predisposed to violence. But what we haven't talked about, and this is another major factor that has law enforcement extraordinarily concerned, that much important elements of the ideological rhetoric used by white extremist leaders have now found its way into our mainstream political rhetoric. So when we have elected officials, when we have people running for office in Europe, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, using the same words as white supremacist leaders, people who are predisposed to violence feel empowered by their words. They listen to what leaders say and they act on it. And so the words that are being used in our political discourse are actually feeding into the violence that has emerged in this country.
John Cohen, formerly of the Department of Homeland Security and now an ABC News contributor, and back to Ian Pannell, our senior foreign correspondent. On that point, he mentions, Ian, that this has not just been a problem in the United States, it has been a problem around the world, and some of these fringe elements, particularly in Europe, have been gaining political power.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo everything that John said. They've been gaining power. They're more represented in the political mainstream. And that arguably provides some air of legitimacy, even if those people who are in the mainstream would never endorse or approve of these kinds of extreme acts, that perhaps the current tenor of political debate provides some kind of cover where people feel legitimized. And again, if you go into some of the detail of this so-called manifesto produced by this attacker, he references a lot of what we now regard as the political mainstream in America and also here in Europe. And some of the responses as well from mainstream politicians, one in particular in Australia, I'm not going to quote from it, but highly offensive to immigrant communities, to minority communities, sort of condemning the attack, but at the same time saying, well, we understand where this is coming from. I would say, again, echoing what John said, yes, these people are able to connect online. But also, the nature of the political debate that we're currently living in means that people are operating in silos. We have much less shared experience, whether it's a case of watching the news or the political discourse. Our differences have become greater than our similarities. And that lack of crossover means that people are just reinforcing their own bigotry and hatred to a point where this kind of act starts to become something that almost seems legitimate. And you have to ask yourself, you know, he releases his manifesto, what kind of message is this designed to send to other people? You know, these people think in advance about the kind of coverage that the conversations that you and I are having now and what kind of impacts that has on other people who may be like-minded. So we have to be very careful about the nature of how we analyze what these people are about, which is why I raise a question of, you know, the mental fitness of these people, people who are able to get weapons and carry out attacks, whether it's a mass murder or whether it's a terrorist attack. You know, they may claim to have a political agenda, but they're also people who are highly unstable, and we should see it for what it is.
Our senior foreign correspondent here at ABC News, Ian Pannell, with us from London. Ian, our thanks to you. We want to catch you up to date as well on the latest with the crash of the Ethiopian Airways plane that killed more than 100 people outside Addis Ababa. ABC's David Curley, our senior transportation correspondent, has the latest.
Aaron, at this hour, we're waiting to hear from Ethiopian officials about the two black boxes. The Ethiopians handed them over to French investigators yesterday to read out the data. The reason is that the chassis, the base that the box sits on, was damaged. The module, the memory module, at least in one of the boxes that we saw, looks fine, but they have to take it off and plug in or put it on another chassis, which apparently the Ethiopians didn't have the ability to do. So the French hope to do that. We're going to get the flight data and hopefully the cockpit voice recorder, what the pilot and co-pilot were actually saying to each other, but it will be up to the Ethiopians to release this information. What we do know is that this aircraft had trouble as soon as it took off, that it had wild ups and down movements from the data that we've seen already. The New York Times reporting overnight that somebody who is familiar with the communications between the aircraft and the tower, that the pilot radioed in early, right after takeoff, that he was having some issues to deal with. And then several minutes later, after they saw some of these wild gyrations, in a panicky voice, he says, we need to return to the airport. But a couple of minutes later, this plane crashed. So the questions we're trying to determine from this data, what caused those wild gyrations? Are they related to the Lion Air crash 4.5 months earlier, in which a 737 MAX also had some wild gyrations? We know that was probably related to a bad sensor that said bad data to the airplane, and a safety feature kicked in that nosed down and the pilots didn't disconnect that automated system. Also, from the crash scene, I've learned from one source that investigators are looking at the jack screw. This is a threaded rod that is in the tail section of the plane, and it controls the horizontal stabilizers, and that's what causes the plane's nose to go up and down. When a pilot wants to go up, the screw moves one way and it noses up. They want to go down, the screw goes the other way and they go down. They're looking at it. That's not surprising because we saw these wild gyrations in the flight of this aircraft. So really right now, it is the French investigators. Can they extract the data? U.S. and other investigators are there in Paris. They will be listening to the cockpit voice recorder and looking at that data. Then we wait for the Ethiopians to give us a sense of what happened in the aircraft from all that data. It may not pinpoint the cause, but it'll lead us to know whether the two crashes are related. Is this grounding of the entire 737 fleet a good idea? A lot of questions could be answered from that data. Aaron?
A lot riding on all this information. ABC's David Curley, our senior transportation correspondent. Today, a number of students around the world are skipping school in order to call attention to climate change. ABC's Armando Garcia at one rally here in New York.
Hi, Aaron. I'm here in New York City in front of the United Nations building, and I'm actually broadcasting on my phone here, so I am going to flip the camera around, so bear with me, just so you can get a little bit of sense of what's actually going on here. Now, although certainly there is a sizable crowd here, the headline of the day is that tens of thousands of teens and preteens are marching today in unison with one purpose, and that is to protest inaction over climate change. Now, nearly 100 countries are participating in events like this across the globe, organized by young leaders, inspired by the likes of Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old Swedish climate activist who just this week was actually nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. And Aaron, if I can add, this march was organized through Google Docs and Slack messages and social media. This is a generation that is so tech savvy and frankly very good at organizing. It is the same generation that gave us the March for Our Lives after the Parkland shooting. Now here the youth are protesting our dependency on the fossil fuel industry, urging politicians to pass policies that will ease the strain of global warming, which many scientists agree has wreaked havoc from our oceans to the mountain peaks of our globe. Now, one last thing I do want to add here is that this march comes during a very crucial time in American politics. There's over a dozen people running for president, and as they campaign, many voters have been asking them to endorse the policies like the Green New Deal, which aim to reduce our dependency on oil, decrease our carbon footprint, and prioritize the issue of global warming. Aaron?
ABC's Armando Garcia from outside the United Nations at one of many rallies going on around the world today to call attention to climate change. There are new concerns that are being raised by the college admissions cheating scandal that we've told you about all week. And I want you to meet Leah Beatty, who's a sophomore at Whitman College in Washington State. Leah has dyslexia and needed extra time, like so many students do, on the SAT. The difference is she needed it legitimately. Her parents didn't pay for it the way some wealthy parents allegedly did, as outlined by prosecutors. So, Leah, why did what happened this week, as outlined by the FBI in Boston, touch such a nerve today?
So it's such a huge slap in the face to students that require accommodations to have a chance at doing their best and doing well. It belittles the system that we use and rely on. It's patronizing and disempowering. We're either invalidated for our disabilities or coddled for them, and the latter leads us to being pitied, and pity has the power of disempowerment.
What was it like for you when you had to go through this whole admissions process, take the SAT and the like?
Yeah, so when I was applying for college, I didn't actually have my formal diagnoses yet, so I never had accommodations for these entrance exams. But I'm incredibly lucky that the place I happened to choose, was a place that recognized me for more than my test scores. And it has a great disability support services system and academic resource center. Looking back, I realized how little information about disability support is provided during the college search. And even if you do find a college with adequate resources, there isn't a guarantee that these services will come to fruition.
You know, since this scandal broke, we've heard from so many parents who have said, you know, my kid actually needs the extra time. A scandal like this is only going to gum up the works. What are you hearing from other students about what they've gone through?
Yeah, I think it's a common misunderstanding of accommodations. And because of this scandal and the alleged cheating that came with the accommodations, the belief that accommodations regularly serve as a guise for cheating is emboldened. We are already marginalized. We already get sideways glances when we're, go to the Academic Resource Center to get extra time. And now we're honestly concerned about outright hostility.
That people won't believe you when you say you may need an accommodation.
Yeah, and accommodations, I mean, they level the playing field. They do not give us an unfair advantage. Very generally, specific learning disabilities can be distilled down to a problem in information processing and production, and accommodations help us with that processing issue, not with the content. So, allowing me to use a keyboard to type my answers allows me to focus on the content of the essay rather than the mechanics of putting the words on the page.
All right, well, so then real quick, give us the pitch. What do you hope the College Board and other administrators of these college entry exams will do, maybe despite what prosecutors outlined this week?
I think there needs to be a greater understanding of how learning disabilities manifest. And with that, better understanding, the legal bearing that, IEPs, 504s, and other documentation about disabilities, will have a more solidified and clear, purpose. Right now they're being abused. But if we understand, how learning disabilities really manifest, we can make better and more accurate diagnoses and be more stringent about, how we're using these documents.
Leah Beatty is an advocate for students with disabilities and a sophomore at Whitman College in Washington State. Leah, thank you so much for joining us after this college admissions scandal broke this week. At the White House, there has been a rebuke by a number of Senate Republicans to President Trump. So we turn to ABC News White House correspondent Karen Travers. This has to do, Karen, with the national emergency the president has declared about the border.
And this was a stunning rebuke yesterday in the Senate, where you had 12 Republicans, Aaron, joining Democrats to approve a resolution that would block that emergency declaration by the president. The president this week had been making a personal appeal to Republicans to stick together and stick with him on this. He said a vote in favor of this resolution was a vote against border security and a vote for Nancy Pelosi. But Aaron, the president's appeals did not end up helping there. You saw 12 Republicans joining the Democrats. But here's what's going to happen now. The president, as you just saw in that one word, all caps tweet, is going to veto this resolution. He was widely expected to do that, and that could come today, his first ever veto. After that, Congress will then reconsider the resolution, but Aaron, it does not look like they have the votes to override that presidential veto, and that's that.
And so automatically then, the funds get transferred the way the president wants, the wall gets built the way he declares?
Not so fast. The president can't cut a check for that money and then start construction of the border wall. The national emergency declaration is going to be tied up in court for some time. You've already seen states suing about the authority that the president has for this and the impact that it could have on funding for their states. So this could take months, if not longer, to make its way through the legal process. Though for now, the president does win this one with the power of that veto pen.
ABC's Karen Travers from her post at the White House. We have a birthday to note as well, and a lot of people came out to celebrate it in Brooklyn. It is the birthday of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and so dozens gathered in order to wish her well on her 86th birthday. Brooklyn's borough president wants to name the municipal building in Brooklyn after RBG, and people signed a card, they held signs, they sang happy birthday. We caught up with a couple of high school students who told us how much Ruth Bader Ginsburg means to them.
When I first heard about it, I thought it was so amazing that they would name a building after a woman, especially such a strong woman, because that's really a first.
As people who grew up in the same borough as her, as people who are looking to, I think when you're looking for a role model, you're looking to see yourself in someone else, and you're looking to see what you can be, and to have that really direct connection to her is so inspiring, and it's moving to know that maybe someday, if we work hard like she did, and if we keep breaking down barriers, we can be that too.
Justice Ginsburg was born on this day in 1933. Things that did not exist then: the Golden Gate Bridge, chocolate chip cookies, and Monopoly. Chocolate chip cookies, really? This is one of many celebrations, the one you're looking at now in Brooklyn, planned in her honor today. Later in Washington, D.C., there are going to be 1,000 people or so at least expected to plank in order to celebrate Justice Ginsburg's big day. And in fact, you should keep tuned to ABC News Live all day. Coming up on The Briefing Room at 3:30 Eastern, the trainer of Justice Ginsburg. We'll be talking to the folks in Washington about her exercise regimen. Yet another reason to keep tuned to ABC News Live. In addition, at 8 p.m., it is the World News Prime. And of course, for all the latest news, just check out our app. I'm Aaron Katursky. Thanks for watching The Debrief, and you're watching ABC News Live.